We have held more than one. We have been warning of a human catastrophe threatening the lives of thousands of dialysis patients in various governorates, but there is no response, Jahaf was quoted as saying by Yemen's Ansarullah news website. He added, "We have addressed the United Nations and health organizations operating in Yemen that we need to provide sufficient drug stocks for dialysis sessions for the year 2023, as we need approximately 500,000 dialysis sessions every year without receiving a response, despite lots of correspondence and meetings in this regard." Stressing that dialysis centers in Yemen are standing on the verge of stopping, Jahaf said the issue will affect the lives of 5,000 patients with kidney failure who need dialysis sessions and drugs, and they may lose their lives if these solutions and medicine are not available urgently. The deputy health minister underscored the importance of opening Sana'a Airport and the port of Hudaydah as they are vital outlets for medicine and food for millions of Yemenis in the besieged areas by the Saudi-led coalition aggression, adding, "In light of the imposed blockade, we are unable as a country to import vital medicine and save our patients." Jahaf went on to say that we are in urgent need within 2 weeks to provide dialysis sessions and our stock has run out. Anis Al-Asbahi, spokesperson for Yemen's Ministry of Health, also called on international organizations to urgently provide dialysis sessions so that dialysis centers would continue to operate and save the lives of Yemeni patients. Asbahi held the United Nations responsible for saving the lives of dialysis patients and responding to the basic requirements of the Yemeni people under the siege, stressing the need to open Sana'a Airport and Hudaydah Port. Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with its Arab allies, with arms and logistics support from the US and other Western states, launched the devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. The objective was to crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of a functional government in Yemen, and reinstall the Riyadh-friendly regime of Abd Rabbo Mansur Hadi. While the Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve any of its objectives, the war has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and spawned the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Meanwhile, Xinhua reported for Islam Fuad, an eye doctor at a public hospital in northern Yemen, the most difficult part of his job is to tell his patients that they have to find treatment elsewhere while knowing most of them will never be able to afford it. At the Al-Jada Health Center in Midi District, Hajjah Province, eye patients from over 20 nearby villages come over for help, but only a few could receive treatment. The doctor told Xinhua after just advising a mother to take her four-year-old boy to other cities for treatment. While the number of eye patients is increasing day by day, the center lacks the equipment and specialist physician to treat eye diseases because of the blockade imposed on us. The mother, Aisha Al-Hadri, said her child Abdullah lost his eyesight 2 weeks after his head was hit by a small stone while playing with his brothers. Hadari told Xinhua, "The doctor told me to take him to specialized hospitals for diagnosis and treatment in other cities or provinces due to the lack of medical equipment here because of the Saudi blockade. The roads have been cut and we cannot go to other provinces, and even if we can, I don't know if we can afford such a trip," the mother said, adding she was afraid that the delay of treatment may cause Abdullah to lose eyesight permanently. The health center is one of the few public clinics that are still operating in Northern Coastal District, as most of the health facilities were destroyed during the Saudi blockade and battles against Yemeni people. The public hospitals in Yemen are severely ill-funded across the war-ravaged country, and most Yemenis who live in abject poverty can never afford the medical bills at private clinics.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Salamun alaikum. You are listening to Lantern, and we have a new story. The title of the story is The Hare and His Ears. The lion had been badly hurt by the horns of a goat, which he was eating. He was very angry to think that any animal that he chose for a meal should be so brazen as to wear such dangerous things as horns to scratch him while he ate. So he commanded that all animals with horns should leave his domains within 24 hours. The command struck terror among the beasts. All those who were so unfortunate as to have horns began to pack up and move out, even the hare, who, as you know, has no horns and so had nothing to fear past the very restless night, dreaming awful dreams about the fearful lion. And when he came out of the warren in the early morning sunshine and there saw the shadow cast by his long and pointed ears, a terrible fright seized him. "Goodbye, neighbor Cricket," he called. "I'm off. He will certainly make out that my ears are horns, no matter what I say." "Dear friend, do not give your enemies the slightest reason to attack your reputation. Your enemies will seize any excuse to attack you."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. This is Beta. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, Lantern. A new story, a new perspective, a new life, a new day. Stay with us. In today's episode, we're going to discuss something really controversial, which was really interesting for me, myself. Let's give you a hint. Don't give your enemies the slightest reason to attack your reputation. Your enemies will seize any excuse to attack you. That was a beautiful sentence, which, you know, seems somehow deep to me. Let's go through the story of facing an enemy. When there is an enemy in your life, how should you respond to that enemy? This is a same old story of all the time, but it has deep roots in everybody's life. I think even in the story of the little rabbit, which we listened to, there was a key point: fear. The hare was afraid of the lion, you know.
So let's discuss the word fear. What does that mean? What is the definition of fear? Actually, fear is a natural human emotion, and it is something that everyone experiences in their lifetime. What matters most is how you fight your fears and whether you let them affect your life. You may not call your feeling fear, you know, you might call it stress, worry, or panic, but often, when we use these words, we are talking about the same emotion, which is fear. When you feel fear, you can experience three types of symptoms, which, as you see, the hero of the old story which we listened to went through the same symptoms too. The first, unhelpful thoughts, such as thinking everyone in the room is having critical thoughts about you, or that something bad will happen. Exactly like the rabbit, which thought, okay, because I have ears and these ears may look like horns to that lion, I have to run away. This way of mindset that rabbit had about, the situation was one of the most important reasons of the feeling of fear. The second reason is physical symptoms such as a rapid heartbeat, faster breathing, sweating, and higher blood pressure, or your body's fight response against, some crucial and essential situations like whatever the hair went through. And the last one is changes in your behavior, ranging from simple things such as avoiding a fun activity to more serious issues like being afraid to leave your home. As you saw it in the story, the rabbit decided to run away from his own hometown. And, it becomes to mind, okay, if fear is that destructive, why should we be afraid of something? But it's not like that. We have two different categories of fear. The first one is healthy fear.
The lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Fear is programmed into your nervous system, and it works instinctively from when you're a baby. It gives you the survival instincts you need to keep yourself safe when you feel like you're in danger. Some fears are healthy. As I told you, there are two categories. The first one is healthy fears. If you see a poisonous snake in your backyard and your fear prompts you to run back into the house and close the door, this is a healthy fear that you may face in your day-to-day life too. The feeling of fear is natural and helps keep you safe, so you shouldn't forget this part. When you face an enemy, it is completely and absolutely natural to feel afraid. You know, it is natural to be afraid. It is natural to, your heartbeat may be faster and so on. But let's come back to our story. What did make the fear of the rabbit irrational? Your fear makes you more cautious. You know, when your fear makes you more cautious than you really need to be, this is somehow the problem. For example, the fear of meeting new people. You know there is no danger in meeting new people, but you still have a special fear in yourself. You know, that stops you doing things you might do if you were completely aware of the consequences. You know what? So, the special fear that rabbit of the story went through is exactly the kind of fear which we call it unhealthy. And you have to recognize these kind of fear to avoid the consequences which may make you, decide to do something which is irrational, completely irrational. Let's go back on the story of today. What would happen if all of the animals of the jungle gathered together and talked to each other, and they had a plan against the lion. They may succeed. Do you agree with me? Of course they do, because there was a lion and a jungle. And of course the jungle is more powerful than the lion. But the incorrect behavior of facing an enemy because of an unhealthy fear made them be like, okay, there is no more hope here, and we have to leave this beautiful house. At the end, what I want to tell you as the gist of the story of today is that if you think you are the supporter of the bright side, you have to be brave too. Bravery is one of the most important factors of facing an enemy. Be brave, be passionate, and believe in whatever you think is true. Thank you for listening to us. It was all the time we had, and I bid you farewell.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
أنا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
This is for a better life. For a better life.
فرمود باعث تو لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. This is For a Better Life for IRIB English Radio. I am Sayyid Mahdi Tawakkul, and one of my specialties is in enhancing the style for living. And my talk is based on the Quran and Islamic tradition. In this episode of the program, I will be going over a new subject, which is how do we deal with our problems? As a preface to my speech, I need to say that our creation is a combination of a body and a soul. Because of the bodily dimension, we are attached to this world, and because of the spirit and our soul, we are connected to the world of unseen. Because of these two aspects of our creation, some of our problems can be solved by referring to our worldly means, and some of them can be solved by being connected to the world of unseen. I mean by the world of unseen, everything that cannot be sensed by our five body senses, like hearing, taste, and everything. Some people in difficulties trying to find a gateway or an escape route through worldly materials only. As a result, they neglect the other part of the creation, which is a spirit. For example, they mostly seek solution by referring to doctors when they are ill, or going to counseling centers trying to gain more money, or by having more fun in their life and whatnot. On the other hand, some people think that since only Allah can solve their problems, it is more practical or more appropriate to talk to Allah only, to pray, to request Him for solving problems, and also they think that since the life of this world will end after a short time, it is better to remain more patient, more tolerant. So they try to sustain many problems. Both of the two mentioned methods are critical and problematic. An intellectual man, a wise man, should pay attention to both sides. From one side, he should have a close relation with Allah, be connected to the world of unseen, and beside it, he should refer to the means that Allah has created in this world. For example, if someone has an illness, he of course should refer to a doctor, but next to it, he should ask Allah to help the doctor to accurately diagnose the disease and prescribe the best medicine. Let me add another example. If there is a man who wants to be admitted to a university and wants to obtain a high academic rank, in addition that he should study or, for example, take part in some remedial classes, use some educational materials, or to study some supplementary books like the textbook and the like, these are the worldly materials, next to it should have a close spiritual connection to Allah, be submissive to Allah's will, and should realize that the only responsibility that he is on his shoulder is to try and just try, but the result and the end is never under his control. In a concise and precise sentence, let me summarize. No worldly dimension should make the man neglectful from a spiritual part of his life, and no spiritual connection should suffice him and prevent him from referring to the worldly available means. Let's have a break, and I will be back shortly.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
I was talking about this fact, that for solving our problems, we must pay attention to both material aspect and spiritual aspect of our life. If paying attention to our worldly facilities and means is more important in our mind, I have to remind that all of these means can only be arranged for us if Allah wills. Without Allah's will, nothing can be practical at all. Even a specialist doctor can make a mistake. He may prescribe the wrong medicine. No matter how genius you are, on a day of your exam, you may fall asleep. And when you are in your way to go to the exam place, you may have an accident. Or on a day of your job interview, these are the examples, you may get sick and lose it. This is what Imam Ali says in one of his noble sayings. He says, I realize that Allah exists since in some cases we see that we do not catch what we strongly have intended to receive, but we cannot receive them. We cannot have them. It means that alongside of being ambitious, we should be ambitious, but alongside of it, when we try to gain what we want, when we try our best to solve our problems, we need to have a close connection to Allah. As a result, both worldly means should accompany the spiritual attitude. None of them should be separated from the other one. Or this point is referred to in many verses of the Quran. For example, in the story of Yaqub and his famous story, which is in regard with his separation with Yusuf, when Yaqub was sustaining the deep sorrow from this separation, he considers both spiritual and worldly matters. On one hand, he says, إِنَّمَا أَشْكُو بَثِّي وَحُزْنِي إِلَى اللَّهِ, I talk about my anguish and grief only to Allah. This is the spiritual connection. Next to this connection, he does not forget that he should do something in this world. And because of this, we read in the following part of the verse or verses that he says to his sons, "Oh, my sons, go and look for Joseph and his brother," because the brother of Yusuf, whose name was Benjamin, was away from Yaqub as well. As we see, Yaqub does not consider his prayer to be sufficient. He knows that he and his other sons should also try to find a way. Interestingly enough, Yaqub once more declares to his children that they also should not think that just looking for Yusuf in normal worldly ways is enough. And because of this, Yaqub adds, وَلَا تَيْأَسُوا مِنْ رَوْحِ اللَّهِ إِنَّهُ لَا يَيْأَسُ مِنْ رَوْحِ اللَّهِ إِلَّا الْقَوْمُ الْكَافِرُونَ. O my children, do not despair of Allah's mercy. Indeed, no one despairs of Allah's mercy except those whose faith to Allah is not complete. We have many emphases in our Islamic sources that action should be next to prayer and praying should be next to doing something. If we pay more attention to both of these two aspects, we can find the life is much easier. A man who is spiritually connected to Allah, his heart is confident in difficulties. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he knows.
In the U.S., a key witness has told the House Select January 6th committee that a lawyer linked to Donald Trump tried to silence her. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Los Angeles Times has covered this story. The Trump-aligned lawyer who initially represented former White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson instructed her to downplay her knowledge of what happened during the Capitol insurrection. Cassidy Hutchinson told the House Select January 6th committee in testimony made public on Thursday, 22nd of December. "We're going to downplay your role," attorney Stephen Passatino told Hutchinson, according to her testimony. "You were a secretary. The less you remember, the better." The details of the apparent Trump World pressure campaign on one of the committee's key witnesses were among a number of revelations and a handful of deposition transcripts the committee made public on Thursday, 22nd of December. The panel's final report, the closing salvo of its 18-month-long investigation, has not yet been released. Cassidy Hutchinson parted ways with Stefan Passantino after several Spring 2021 appearances before the committee, in which she felt she was giving untruthful or incomplete answers, she said. After switching attorneys, she provided some of the most dramatic live testimony of the panel's 9 hearings this year. According to Hutchinson, Passantino did not want her to tell the committee that former President Donald Trump had lunged at his security detail when they refused to take him to the Capitol during the riot on 6th of January 2021. Hutchinson felt she had no other option but to retain the Trump-aligned lawyer because she couldn't afford to pay the high costs of other attorneys she contacted while seeking representation. She told the committee in 2 days of depositions back in September. Stefan Passantino would not tell her who was paying for his legal services, Hutchinson told the committee, and she soon became leery, suspecting he was more concerned about Donald Trump and other high-ranking former White House officials than he was about her. I'm completely indebted to these people, she recalled telling her mother. I was like, and they will ruin my life, Mum, if I do anything that they don't want me to do. Passantino encouraged her to downplay her role as one of former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows' most trusted aides, she said, and urged her to answer questions with the phrase, I cannot recall, even when she had clear memories of what had happened. Cassidy Hutchinson said Stefan Passantino and others in Donald Trump's orbit, including Mark Meadows, through an intermediary, kept reminding her to be loyal and repeatedly spoke of finding her a well-paid job after her interviews with the committee. We just want to focus on protecting the president. We all know you're loyal, Hutchinson said, Passantino told her. In a statement first reported by CNN, Passantino said he represented Hutchinson as he had other clients honorably, ethically, and fully consistent with her sole interests as she communicated them to me. Also released on Thursday, 22nd of December, were transcripts of the committee's interviews with Chris Krebs, former director of Homeland Security's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Convicted January 6 rioter Stephen Ayers, former Defense Secretary Mark Esper, Justice Department employee Ken Kulikowski, and Sarah Matthews, a former Deputy White House Press Secretary. Ken Kulikowski, whose transcript shows he told the committee he could not recall the answer to most of their questions, has connections to some of the most influential players in the effort to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Associated Press has also covered the same story. Former White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson described to the House January 6 committee a wide-ranging pressure campaign from Donald Trump's allies aimed at influencing her cooperation with Congress and stifling potentially damaging testimony about Trump. An extraordinary closed-door testimony made public on Thursday, 22nd of December, Cassidy Hutchinson recounted how those in the former president's circle dangled job opportunities and financial assistance as she was cooperating with the committee investigating the Capitol riot, and how her own lawyer, a former ethics counsel in the Trump White House, advised her against being fully forthcoming with lawmakers and told her, the less you remember, the better. The 9-member committee released 2 never-before-seen transcripts of Hutchinson's testimony as it tries to wrap up its investigation and make its work public. The committee, which will dissolve when Republicans take over the House of Representatives on 3rd of January, was also expected to release its final report on Thursday. The transcripts provide previously unknown details about what Cassidy Hutchinson called the moral struggle, torn between the desire to speak the truth and to remain loyal to Donald Trump, that she says she endured on the way to becoming one of the most memorable witnesses of the committee's investigation. In a televised hearing back in June, Hutchinson went public about Donald Trump's actions on 6th of January 2021. She described his directive that magnetometers be removed from a rally of his supporters on that day and detailed his angry and ultimately rebuffed demands to be taken by the Secret Service to the Capitol to join the crowd trying to disrupt the congressional certification of Joe Biden's election victory. In my mind, this whole time, I felt this moral struggle, she said. According to the transcript, she described a first interview with the committee in which she concealed testimony about Donald Trump that, months later, she would deliver to a rapt hearing room. Looking back now, she said, it feels ridiculous because in my heart I knew where my loyalties lied, and my loyalties lied with the truth, and I never wanted to diverge from that. You know, I never wanted or thought that I would be the witness that I have become, because I thought that more people would be willing to speak out to. But to hear her tell it, the testimony was never a sure thing. Like other aides whose proximity to Donald Trump entangled them in investigations, Cassidy Hutchinson scrambled to find a lawyer after receiving a subpoena from the committee last year. Former White House officials and Trump allies worked to line up a lawyer for her, despite her own discomfort at being represented by someone in Trump world, an affiliation she feared would make her indebted to these people. She said she was contacted in February by Stephen Passantino, a former White House ethics counsel who told her he would be her lawyer. He said she would not have to pay for his services, but demurred when she asked from where the money was coming. She later learned that it was from Trump allies.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed.
His decree, though, we learn...
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip, what are the secrets of the Salah and how can the Salah help us in our ubudiyah, our obedience, our servitude, and our worship to Allah. So, dear listeners, we are humbly talking about how the Salah, the Namaz, or the five daily prayers, the wajib obligatory prayers that we pray, how the Salah helps us in our ubudiyah, our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to Allah. Now, one of the things that we find is there is a verse in the Holy Quran, which of course is the very word of the Almighty Allah, where Allah says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, the Salah forbids lewdness, profanity, and vice. Now, based upon this Quranic text and this Quranic statement and this Quranic fundamental principle, we are going to discuss this issue about how the Salah helps us in our ubudiyah. Now, of course, when it comes to ubudiyah, the servitude, the worship, and the obedience to Allah, there are different factors and variables which come into play. Now, one of the things that weakens our ubudiyah, of course, is to commit sin. Now, these sins can be in different categories. But one such category that we find that sins are contained within, of course, is this idea of vice, lewdness, or profanity. And here the Holy Quran tells us that the Salah forbids these things. So right off the bat, we understand that when we do our daily prayers on time, of course, but the variables we will talk about later, but when we do our Salah, it should and it will forbid these kind of negative aspects and these negative morals and bad ethics. So the first way that the Salah helps us to increase our ubudiyah is because it forbids and prevents us from committing certain kinds of sins. Now, there is a caveat here that Salah, the more one pays attention and the more one has presence of heart, the more this Salah is powerful and the more it is of a strong elixir or a strong medicine. Because, of course, there might be some of us out there who say that, well, I pray five times a day, still I feel like that there are certain sins that I still commit in my daily life. Now, there's various ways to kind of dissect this question. The first one being that, well, perhaps the Salah, which is talked about in the verse of the Holy Quran, is a very powerful, high-level spiritual form of the Salah, a complete form of the Salah. Meaning if we do our daily prayers and we barely pay attention to what we are saying, we don't know what it means, we don't have presence of heart, we're not focusing on the Almighty Allah, we don't realize what the prayer is, we're just doing it to do it out of habit or custom, then of course that is one of the reasons why potentially it is not helping us to be able to prevent committing certain sins, including profanity and other kinds of vice. The second thing is that perhaps there are other factors that are involved. So for example, if you want to be healthy, you exercise and you eat right and you sleep right and you take care of your body, you weigh yourself. Meaning in order to accomplish one thing, which is this healthy body, you have to do these various different things. And so in our example, what we're saying is that if you want to keep your soul strong and protected and purified, and you want it to refrain from committing sins, then the Salat is one of those things which will help you. But there are also other things that must be done along with this prayers and these five daily prayers in order to be able to completely prevent yourself from committing certain kinds of sins. And so this is how Salah, in this second aspect, helps us to prevent ourselves from sinning.
شربنا على فكري
حبيبي مدامتا
ساكرنا بها من قال
لأن يخلق الكرم
IRIB English Radio.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
On the Day of Judgment, I'd rather be one of the people that's shaded because they spent their youth worshiping Allah. And like nowadays, I'm getting closer and I'm striving for it. But I wish I started when I was younger, so now I could, you know, have more background instead of starting now when I'm 17.
I'm at the age of 26, and while alhamdulillah, I'm a hafiz, but I still feel like I haven't accomplished as much as I should by this age compared to what others have accomplished. So inshallah, I'm taking steps to be able to financially support my family and pursue deen, and I'm taking those steps now. But I regret not having come far so you know, that far.
This is easy for me. Not bowing down soon enough, not submitting to Allah soon enough. Too many years of not realizing that Allah is our creator. That's unfortunate, but I pray Allah forgive me for that.
I think most of my regrets are in the future. Like, for me, it's like I imagine myself as an old man thinking back on my life and asking whether or not I regret the things I'm doing now. And so there, like, that's where regret lives for me. Regret lives in the heart of an 80-year-old man in the future. So that guides me in a way, and it's sometimes scary in a way. And I guess what I worry he'll regret is that he lived a meaningless life.
As far as regrets, I understand that it's already written. And so there's a lot of things that I've done. I hit a referee in high school and I never got to play football again. And I was really good at football. But I understand that that's what Allah had planned for me because I was excellent at football. So to regret that would feel like I'm displeased with my Lord, what God had written for me. So I wouldn't call that a regret, though I could have been a star NFL player as passionate and as strong as I was in football. So now I coach young men to be disciplined, strong in football.
There's wisdom in everything that you do or don't do. And Allah, there's a teachable moment somewhere in that you've done. Even like when, like if you said something to a friend that you didn't want to say, or maybe you didn't, there was a beautiful sister that you wanted to go ask if she was single or something like that, and you didn't. You have to trust in Allah. Because really, if you don't have any trust with Allah, then who are we, a people of faith? Because there's always the reason why something happens to you, the reason why you don't do something, you have to trust where Allah is taking you or where He's not taking you. When I went to Northern California, I went to a school that I eventually failed out of, but I was introduced to Islam there. So it's like, well, I wasted 4 years of my life, but I became Muslim from that experience. So it's like, I mean, now I'm here sitting here talking to you. And so, and my experiences of being a Muslim, like, just amazing. So, I mean, do I have regrets? Yeah, but I mean, with a longer, deeper view of things, you're like, oh, I see why that happened.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.ir.
أجب دعائي يا رجائي بالرضا والخير، أنر طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
يا الله يا رحمن حقق أمانينا وفقنا في كل آن في مسائنا.
Welcome back to your listeners. Now, in continuation to what we were talking about, which was how the Salah forbids and prevents us from committing certain kinds of sins, and especially, for example, lewdness or profanity or vice or these kind of things. Now, we had said, of course, that there are different aspects that are involved here. You know, we said first and foremost, when it comes to our ubudiyah, our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to the Almighty Allah, well, first and foremost, the salah, it forbids us from committing certain kinds of sins. And then after that, we said, well, perhaps some people might say that the salah, for some reason, does not help me to prevent committing these kinds of sins. So we had broken it down into two different aspects. We said the first, that perhaps the salah itself has some kind of flaw, or it is not in a perfected state in which it should be able to do the healing, the spiritual healing that it's supposed to and it's not. And the second thing was that perhaps we are doing other things which weigh down that salah from helping us to attain that spiritual healing, which helps us to not commit certain kinds of sins. Now, we kind of wanted to talk a little bit more about the second aspect in case it was still a little bit ambiguous, and perhaps it is a little bit ambiguous, and that is, well, so what do we mean when we're saying that we are doing the salah, we are doing it on time, we are doing it with focus and with attention, we are doing it with a presence of heart, presence of mind, we are aware of what we are saying, we are aware of what we are doing, we are aware of the actions that we are committing, whether it is ruku, bowing, or whether it is sajda, prostration, or whether it's standing still in the presence of the Almighty Allah. So let's say we're doing all of those prerequisites which make our salah a very powerful spiritual remedy. But the second thing that we had talked about was this idea that perhaps we are doing something alongside this salah that is preventing this salah from being strong. We had given this interesting example about being healthy and the different things that we need to do. Now, so let's say we're doing all the things that we need to do when it comes to the salah and the five daily prayers, but at the same time we are lying, we are cheating, we are backbiting, we are gossiping, or God forbid, our income is haram, or the food that we eat is haram, or we are drinking wine and alcohol, or God forbid, we are looking at things which we are not supposed to be looking at, or we are listening to things which we are not supposed to be listening to, and things along these lines. So these other variables, you know, if you take the soul as a metaphor for a pigeon, right, or a bird, or the other way around, if you take the bird to be a metaphor for the soul, now the soul will fly with the salah, but these various different sins, they pull this bird down, they weigh down this bird so that it cannot fly. And so it is not necessarily, well, I think we can go ahead and safely say that surely the Holy Quran is correct when it says that the salah forbids lewdness and profanity and vice. The problem is not in this statement of the Quran when we say ourselves that the salah is not forbidding me from committing sins. The problem is with me. I am the one who is either not correctly performing the salah, or I am doing things alongside the salah which is preventing that daily prayer from cleaning and purifying and spiritually healing every single one of us. And this is the relation and the beautiful relation from among the many beautiful relations of salah with our ubudiyah, our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. أحتمي بحما حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير. A diverse range of programs. Spirituality.
youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Tunisia is still in political turmoil even after the recent parliamentary election, with the main opposition coalition calling on President Kais Saied to step down following an extremely low voter turnout. Politicians are now claiming that the country is back to square one in terms of democracy.
We are all now back to square one. Over the last 10 years, freedom prevailed over each corner of the country, and each one of you had the liberty to express himself completely, freely move, and to freely listen, to run in elections, and to freely vote. We were among the developed democratic states in the last 10 years, and this fact cannot be denied.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the fluid political situation in Tunisia after the country's parliamentary election, with the opposition insisting that the low voter turnout practically left the head of state without legitimacy. The second part of the show will be on continued protests in Morocco against the kingdom's normalization with the Israeli regime. Moroccans also led the world in voicing solidarity with Palestine during the 2022 FIFA World Cup in Qatar. So stay with us as our experts give us their incisive analyses. And you can also be part of the conversation by sending your comments through our social media handle.
Tunisia after elections. Tunisia's December 17 parliamentary election, the first since Tunisian President Kais Saied took over most powers in July 2021, recorded the lowest electoral turnout in its recent history. The country's main opposition alliance called on Saied to leave immediately as voters overwhelmingly snubbed the legislative election in what officials at the country's elections commission said was a participation rate of 8.8%.
Tunisia has been in a deep political crisis that aggravated the country's economic conditions since 2021, when President Kais Saied ousted the government and dissolved parliament. While the Tunisian president insists that his measures were meant to save the country, critics have accused him of orchestrating a coup. Secretary General of the Republican Party, Issam Chebbi, elaborates here on why they boycotted the last elections.
We decided to boycott the upcoming elections. This move is in response to an electoral law written by Saied alone, part of a coup against constitutional legitimacy.
Now, for more on the political situation in Tunisia, we have contacted Sami Hamdi. He's the editor-in-chief of the International Interest. Now, what was the reason for the historically low turnout during Tunisia's last parliamentary election?
I think when it comes to the historically low turnout, I think what's important to note is that all the Tunisians knew that these elections were not about trying to establish a new mandate. They were not about trying to establish a new legitimacy for Kais Saied. The opposition parties were prevented from running. Many candidates were prevented from running. And everybody essentially believed that these elections would not be free and fair, that it was a way for Kais Saied simply to try to close the chapter on the parliament that he suspended and to essentially offer an avenue for international recognition of his toppling of the constitution and the suspension of parliament. So for the people, for the Tunisian people, they knew that these elections were not for them. They knew these elections were not about change. They knew these elections were not about asking them who they want to rule, but rather it was simply an orchestrated show designed to try to give this image of democracy rather than actually implementing democracy. And this is why Tunisians stayed away, because they believe that irrespective of whether they voted or not, it would not make any impact whatsoever.